Zampella. We're not on the air. You can find our news reports on WSLR.org. We're also on X, Instagram, and Facebook. Listen to us anytime on all major podcasting platforms. Thank you for paying attention. I am
You are
Johannes
listening Bell. To WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at WSLR.org. The views and opinions expressed on this show by me and my guests do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WSLR staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson is a marine biologist, policy advisor, writer, and co-founder of the nonprofit think tank Urban Ocean Lab. Her new book, What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures, is a collection of interviews and essays. Thanks so much for being here with me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How dire is it? What should we expect if we don't make major changes in terms of burning fossil fuels and how we manage and protect the environment?
We should expect a lot of very bad things. And I should preface the longer answer by saying that is not what this book is about. I mean, you've had a chance to take a look at it, and I sort of try to condense all that into one short chapter at the beginning. But it is important, of course, to make sure people understand the stakes, right? What's at risk? And so we could expect more wildfires, more droughts, more floods, more hurricanes, more sea level rise. It's all a matter of how much of each of those things we're going to get. There's no going back in a time machine. The climate has already changed, but we're trying to now, in some ways, minimize the future changes, the harms, and think about how we can adapt to this new world.
And the reason I ask is because I think there's a lot of complacency around what's going to be happening in the near future. We've had so many years of people saying bad things are coming, and now people are kind of going, well, I mean, it's not too bad yet.
I mean, it depends where you look. I was horrified seeing the flooding in Vermont last year. That's something no one expected, just absolute devastation in small towns across that state, which was thought to be a safe place to live in a climate-changed world. We're seeing wildfires that are putting tons of people at risk. We're seeing crop failures in the Midwest because of droughts, right? It is already here. We're just not absorbing it in the way that I think we need to come to grips with reality. We're seeing places where people can't live anymore because it's too hot or because the flooding is so bad over and over and over again, they just can't handle it, right? So I think part of it is a challenge of the media not really packaging that up for us. One of the statistics I learned when researching this book was if you look at the major TV news stations, less than 1% of news airtime minutes are about climate change. And that's actually gone down. It was up to 1.2% a few years ago, and then last year it dropped to 0.9%. So it's actually possible to go through the world not really thinking about this stuff.
And it seems like we're going to need to make some big changes, and it needs to be at a very high level and a grassroots level. But let's talk a little bit about the Green New Deal. How has that worked out?
So just for context, the Green New Deal was proposed, introduced by Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey as a resolution of Congress. So it wasn't a bill that would become a law. A resolution is a basically a statement of intent. It's a policy framework. It's a vision statement of what it would look like if the U.S. comprehensively put in place climate policy. It's actually a very short document. I think it's like 12 pages, double-spaced, large font, written in plain English. I would encourage folks to read it because there's so much press about it's awful or it's perfect, but it actually is something we could each form our own opinions on in just a few minutes of skimming. And so I think that there is no one piece of legislation that would implement the Green New Deal because it is a very comprehensive vision. It would take dozens of pieces of legislation to make that happen, some of which have been introduced. And there's been some major climate policy changes, wins in the U.S. in the past few years, primary among those, the Inflation Reduction Act, which actually had almost $4 billion of in there for climate solutions. And the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act as well. But the Green New Deal in particular is like not a thing that we can ever really check off as being done. However, it did absolutely raise the bar and force politicians to think about climate policy in a different way. It set the stage for a 2020 presidential primary where everyone had to have a climate policy platform, which was totally new in American politics. Everyone competing for who had the best climate policy. It was just a really effective race to the top. And that set up this thing where, you know, because you had Governor Jay Inslee running on a climate platform exclusively, when he dropped out of the race, Elizabeth Warren picked up a lot of his ideas and carried those forward. And when she dropped out of the race, Bernie Sanders picked up a lot of those ideas and carried them forward. And when he dropped out of the race, Biden picked up a lot of those ideas. And a lot of those staffers that worked on those policies ended up in the White House, ended up in federal agencies writing policy. So while it's hard to point to, and in fact, impossible to point to any one thing that says it was a success or a failure, or this is exactly how far we've gotten, it did very much change the public conversation and set this expectation driven by young people who said, "You are setting our future on fire, please. Grown-ups, do something about this." We now have a very different public discourse about, of course, we need climate policy. It's just a matter of what exactly it's going to be.
You proposed a Blue New Deal. Can you talk a little bit about why we needed a Blue New Deal and what it is?
Sure. So when I read the Green New Deal, I was like, they left out the ocean. There was one tiny mention of the ocean on like page 10 or 11. As in a list of things we should protect. And as a marine biologist, as someone who's been working on climate policy, ocean climate policy for many years, I know that if we leave the ocean out of the conversation, we're leaving out a huge portion of the solutions. The latest estimate is something like 30% of the climate solutions we need are found in the ocean. That includes renewable offshore energy, that includes sustainable seafood, especially regenerative ocean farming of seaweeds and shellfish, that includes protecting and restoring coastal ecosystems that absorb a lot of carbon, that protect our shorelines from sea level rise and storms. There's so much opportunity there to decarbonize shipping, etc. And so I wanted to highlight all of those solutions. We often, when we think about the ocean and climate change, we think about all the ways climate is really messing up the ocean, making it too hot, making it more acidic, changing currents, making it hard for animals that grow shells to grow shells and to live where they want to live, and fish are migrating towards the poles in search of cooler water. And all of this is true, but also the ocean is a place to turn to look for solutions. So the Blue New Deal was envisioned with a bunch of colleagues of mine to complement the green one and to say we really do need to include the ocean specifically as we're framing climate policy.
And since the ocean is your wheelhouse, mangroves and coastal wetlands apparently can hold up to 5 times more carbon per hectare than tropical forests. Do we have any sort of adequate plans for mangrove restoration?
I think people are starting to appreciate the magic of mangroves, but it's often sort of one of the first things to get bulldozed because there's a lot of mosquitoes, or people want to build beach houses or something. And so it's definitely something I've been advocating for protecting, but we don't have any sort of broad sweeping mangrove protection policies that I know of in the U.S. We also don't have very many mangroves in the U.S. It is a very much a tropical species. So there's some in Florida and maybe Louisiana, but yeah, not very widespread here.
Even if we restored all the mangroves in Florida, it wouldn't have that big of an impact on, I mean, it would have on people in Florida because it helps to buffer the hurricanes and all that kind of stuff. But as far as the larger picture.
But it would absolutely have, as you mentioned, these other benefits. These protection from storm impacts is a huge benefit of mangroves. They are the nursery ground for baby fish and lobsters and those species that we want to eat when they get bigger. And those are habitats that do absorb a lot of carbon and can help rebalance things. And every little bit helps.
Okay, so one of the chapters in your book is about kelp farming and ocean farming. Seems like that might have a bigger impact.
Yeah, that can certainly be done at a significant scale. I'm just appreciating all these ocean questions you're asking me and questions from every section of the book. Like, you really got through this. I'm impressed. So that interview was with Bren Smith, the co-founder of an organization called GreenWave that supports the development of regenerative ocean farming and training people to become ocean farmers as they envision it. It's really focused on seaweed and shellfish, so oysters and mussels and clams, with the premise that that is the most sustainable form of seafood because it requires, or of food maybe more generally, because it requires no land, no fresh water, no fertilizers, no pesticides. It really is photosynthesis, then the nutrients in seawater. And so that is this incredible opportunity to feed people with a very low carbon footprint, as well as seaweed can be used for all sorts of things. Like, it can be a replacement for plastic packaging. It can be used in fertilizer for agriculture, on land, etc. So my mom was actually just reading the book last night, and she and I have been following Bren Smith's work together for many years. And it was pretty fun to walk into her bedroom and see her up late at night past her bedtime reading under the light my own book, which was just very sweet. That very practical solution that he brings, Bren talks a lot about working class environmentalism, blue collar climate solutions, because there's a really elegant practicality to the work he's doing and more broadly to a lot of the work that needs to be done, right? We need electricians and plumbers and carpenters and pipe fitters helping to shape this wave of climate adaptation that we need.
When they were looking for uses for the kelp, he was saying, oh, well, we can use this for a fertilizer. And a lot of the agricultural runoff from the Midwest comes down the Mississippi into the Gulf. And then if they could farm kelp there, what they're doing is using the nutrients that are now polluting the Gulf to actually grow more food, clean the water. And it's like, what a great way to give people jobs, clean up the environment. Is that what you mean by a circular economy?
Not quite. I mean, that I would describe as like a circular system, or like closing the loop in some way, right? You're having all this erosion of topsoil and nutrients and excess fertilizers being used on farmland all across the U.S. certainly, and globally as well. And then that creates these dead zones, algae blooms that sink and cause oxygen depletion as they're decomposing, which is, oxygen depletion is bad for the fish, and then the fish aren't doing well, right, etc. And the life on the seafloor suffers. So how could we help to break that bad cycle by absorbing those excess nutrients and bringing them back into the soil? But a circular economy is, I don't have like a quick definition memorized, but it's the idea that it's a circle and not a one-way chain that ends in the landfill, right? We are repairing and refurbishing things. We are deconstructing things instead of demolishing them. And we are trying to just keep everything in circulation in a way that there's no waste.
That's a concept that people need to start pushing for, it because this planned obsolescence, that, and the idea that you would make things that would wind up in a landfill has just really impacted the environment in a very negative way. That's a concept that we need to talk about more.
Yeah, and one of the very easy things that we can do, easier in some places than others, is to think about composting. Food waste is a huge source of methane emissions. When food rots in a landfill, it emits a very potent greenhouse gas, methane. But if it is composted, it instead can go back into the soil and be recycled in this circular system. So for people who are looking for a way to be more circular at home, I would say see what options are available to you in terms of municipal or community composting, or if you have a garden like I do, you can do it at home.
Volunteer with All Faiths Food Bank. All Faiths Food Bank in Sarasota is a local nonprofit organization that could use your help. They have a number of outreach programs in need of volunteers. If you're interested, reach out to them by calling 941-379-6333 or check them out on their website at allfaithsfoodbank.org. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest today is Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, and her book is What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures. We were talking about the idea of a circular economy.
The other piece of that circularity is sort of, as you were mentioning, with appliances and things like that, like to invest in repair. One of my dreams is that every community would have a repair shop and be able to have a place nearby you could take things to fix your blender or whatever it was that was broken instead of throwing it out. But it's hard to get spare parts. We don't all have these fix-it skills, and so we just give up on stuff, and it either goes in the trash or just collects in the basement or the garage and collects dust. And that would be a big cultural shift, and shift our mindsets to thinking about how we value the things we own, how do we refurbish and repair what we already have instead of digging up more metal and making all these new things.
It wasn't that long ago that this mindset changed, because I can remember my brother had a job repairing small appliances when he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And you don't see those kinds of shops anymore. It's interesting because a lot of these shifts have just happened in the last 40 or 50 years. And younger people who have only seen what we have now don't realize how fast this has changed.
Yeah, it's the same with plastic. I mean, plastic was not a thing like this disposable single-use stuff. In the 70s, it was all brand new then, right?
So right.
When we think about cultural change, this is only really the second or third generation in many generations of human history that's been living this way. So we do actually have, in the memory of people still living, a very different way that things could be.
There's this feeling of, wow, it's so hopeless because so many things need to change. And that's true. Many things need to change, but it wasn't that long ago that things were very different. We need to start restoring land and change the way we do agriculture. And in the book, it said that there's about $140 trillion of benefit annually by restoring the land. Why aren't we seeing more investment in this sort of thing?
A very boring part of the reason is we don't have a financial system that's set up to value these things, and we don't have the right incentives in place, and we don't have creative enough business people to think about this. We don't have enough people with resources who are tuned in to the scale of the problem and also the opportunities that exist for investing in solutions. So I don't know exactly why, but that's sort of my inkling.
So let's talk a little bit about the banking system, because apparently the banking system is a big part of the problem.
We basically have the four biggest banks in the U.S., J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citibank. Those are the biggest investors in fossil fuels. They are funding the expansion of oil and gas drilling, of fracking, of pipeline construction. And so any of us who have money there or have credit cards with them are funding the expansion of fossil fuels, when I think many of us would much rather have our money go to this transition towards a renewable, regenerative economy. And so we need to think about how to make sure our money is working towards solutions instead of advancing the problem.
Do you know if there's any organizations that people who, like, say, have a retirement account and they want to invest, but they want to make sure it's not going towards keeping the planet burning? Are there specific organizations that you think are doing a good job?
There's a website called bankforgood.org that has some good options for people to think about if they want to move their money. And greenportfolio.com is another one on the investment side. I personally have my not that large investments in Betterment, which has a climate fund. But there are many options out there now for individuals to think about. And it actually makes a very big difference, because if you have, say, $125,000 saved up for your retirement that's invested in fossil fuels, at least in part, your money in that account could be doing more harm, so much harm that it wipes out all the good that you could be doing by eating a plant-based diet and walking and biking as much as you can and reducing your consumption of all sorts of things, right? And I think that was one of the things I learned researching this book that really struck me, that it absolutely matters where we have our money and how important it is to vote with our dollars.
So along with the monetary system, we also need to look at our food system, because apparently that's a huge part of the problem too.
This is the thing we talk about a lot, the importance of a plant-based diet. And it's not about 100% vegan all the time or anything like that, but this shift to eating more plants and less meat is certainly one of the important things we can do. And thinking about agriculture in ways that are regenerative and heal the soil, thinking about compost and mulching and less tilling, protecting topsoil and making sure to use minimal pesticides, if any at all, so we can protect biodiversity and the ecosystems around farms, right? There's so much that we can do to make agriculture better. We all need to eat. So figuring out how to do that well and in a way that cares for workers and doesn't expose them to poisons, or in many cases now, the intense heat that we're experiencing in different places for people who work outside is becoming a risk as well. So we just need to find ways to be gentler with the planet and take care of each other. It sounds sort of whimsical to put it that way, but that's what this moment calls for, is a cultural shift towards thinking more in that direction.
I know when the Soviet Union collapsed, one of the things that made it less awful for the people involved was a lot of people had dachas with small garden plots. And the idea of a climate victory garden seems like the same sort of thing. So what's a climate victory garden, and how would this help?
So that's a term that comes out of the world wars and what people in the U.S. were doing when so many men were at war. People who stayed home were growing food, sending to the troops and to feed their families, neighborhoods, communities. In World War II, by 1944, which is the year my mother was born, nearly 20 million victory gardens produced 8 million tons of food, around 40% of the fresh fruits and vegetables consumed in the U.S. at the time. And so to me, that's a very important example of scale. We think about, oh, I'm just one person, what difference does it make? But you can see, like, if everyone starts doing it, if there are 20 million victory gardens, we don't have to ship as much produce all around the country and the world, if we're eating locally and not burning fossil fuels to get some lettuce, then that can be a useful thing to do. And it's also just delightful. I love walking out into the front of in my little garden and picking herbs to have with my dinner, at the very least, ramping up again. You know, my mom's been farming for the last 20 years and she just moved in with me. And now we're thinking about how we're going to start a food garden, a climate victory garden together. And it's just, there's no downside to a lot of this stuff, right? We're not going to save the planet with our little garden, but it's a contribution and it's just a wonderful way to spend some time and have your hands in the dirt and eat something fresh.
And use up your compost.
And use our compost, exactly.
There was one idea that was put forth to put carbon footprint information on products, just like the nutritional information. Do you know if there's been any traction on that? I love that. Because if you have two products and they're functionally the same, but you can say, oh, but this company is really doing something to lower the carbon footprint.
It's something that I've been wishing for a long time. This came up in an interview with Paola Antonelli, who's the curator of design at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, a friend of mine. And yeah, it's something that as a designer, she has thought a lot about. How do we design systems and information to help people make better decisions? Because as you described, like, we have this very large number of choices. Often if we go into a supermarket or an electronics store or whatever, a clothing store, and we don't really have the information that we would need to know which is the better choice for the earth or humanity. So no, I don't know of any efforts like that on a large scale yet, but maybe someone listening will want to kick that off.
Exactly. Let's plant some seeds. And I do have one more ocean question. What is the Billion Oyster Project?
That is a nonprofit in New York City that I used to be on the board of directors for. Their goal is to replant a billion oysters in New York Harbor by 2035 and to involve a million school children in the process. So the idea there is New York Harbor used to have something like a few trillion oysters. Oysters are filter feeders. So they were constantly filtering and purifying the water. But of course, oysters cannot swim away when you go to catch them. So they were overfished very quickly 100 or so years ago. I mean, people think of hot dog carts on the streets of New York if you've been there, but it used to be oyster carts. And that was a big, and oyster shells were, you know, lining the streets before everything was concrete. So the goal of that project is to restore some of that ecosystem to New York Harbor. But it's very hard because the water quality is different. And once you get a small enough number of oysters, it's hard for them to reproduce in the wild because they just don't find each other that well because their larvae are free swimming. And so they're just swimming around, and wherever they settle down may not be near enough other oysters that when they grow up, they can make babies. So they've got a lot of hurdles to overcome. But yeah, that project has been going for a bunch of years, and it's trained a whole generation of young people to scuba dive, to do the research science, to be boat drivers. So there's lots of other wonderful benefits of that project societally, apart from just getting those oysters back in the water, doing their jobs in the ecosystem.
You've spent a lot of years studying the problems and talking to people who are coming up with solutions. But I keep hearing all these reports about how we're running out of time and things aren't changing fast enough. How optimistic are you for the future?
I don't consider myself an optimist. I think that's because I'm a scientist. So I like to think of myself as a realist, right? I've seen the scientific projections of different possible futures, but all those projections depend on what we do. There is a huge array of possible futures. And the word that I hold on to is not hope or optimism, but possibility. And so what I think about in my work is how can I help to make sure we have the best possible future, even if it's not a perfect one. So, I mean, the title of my book is What If We Get It Right? But it does have a question mark at the end. And I think it's just a time when we need to be asking ourselves a lot of these big what if questions. This has been A truly delightful conversation. Thank you. And check out the website. There's lots of resources on there. There's a reading guide. There's references. There's a worksheet to download and fill out your own climate action Venn diagram. There's a playlist of songs that I think would be really inspiring to folks. And all that is at getitright.earth.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest today has been Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, and we've been talking about her book, What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures.